In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Carl Phillips. He is probably best known as a novelist. He's also written some works of nonfiction, and we'll be talking this morning about his most recent, the title of that book being The Atlantic Sound. It is a book that's difficult to describe in just a few lines. It is it's partly travel writing. Partly it is a personal kind of story, of a personal journey, and it's partly also social history, because it is, in part, about the Atlantic slave trade and about the triangle that was created between Africa, the United States, the southern parts of the United States, and Britain, which is a path that the guest follows in writing about that. But in a much larger sense, it's really about the idea of identity, something that he has explored a good deal in his writing. A bit more about him, just before we introduce you to him. He was born in St. Kitts in the West Indies, and then the year he was born, his family moved to England. He was brought up there in Leeds and went to school at Oxford. He's written scripts for film, theater, radio, and television. He is the author of a previous book of nonfiction titled The European Tribe. He's also written six novels. He has received a number of awards for his writing, including the Martin Luther King Memorial Prize and a Guggenheim Fellowship. He also was at one point shortlisted for the Booker Prize, which is the top literary honor in Britain. And his recent book, the one here we're talking about, is The Atlantic Sound, and it's published by Knopf. He makes his home in New York, but this morning he's talking with us from Chicago. And as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-WILL. Mr. Phillips, hello.
Morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I found a quote that I think I'd like to ask you about and might be a good way to start. And this was actually, I think it was at a point where you were spending some time at Barnard. And there was a little material here that I got off of their website where they include this quote from you where you say that I'm very interested in people with multiple identities. You go on to say, that's what I consider the state of the modern world, and it's certainly the prevailing condition in New York City. Why are you interested in people with multiple identities?
I think largely because I have a multiple identity myself. As you mentioned in your introduction, I was born in the West Indies. I am a British citizen. I grew up in Britain. I also happen to be an American resident, so in a sense, the vaguest autobiographical outlines of my own life defy singular categorization. So there's a sort of plurality to my own upbringing. The second reason I'm interested in this idea of multiple identities is I grew up in a country which doesn't easily accommodate people who have multiple identities or plural identities. Britain is a very or likes to perceive of itself as a very homogenous country, a country in which one doesn't hyphenate. You know, it's very difficult to think of oneself as an African Briton or as an Irish Briton in the way in which you can utilize these terms in this country in terms of Irish Americans, African Americans, Swedish Americans, and so on.
Is this somehow particularly acute, the issue of identity, being someone of with African roots, or is that not so much an issue there anymore? And it's just, as you say, a very issue that's somehow real for everyone, and it doesn't matter where your roots are.
Well, I think it's an issue that's real for everybody. I mean, I listened to you talking interestingly about the idea of having somebody come on and put an opposite point of view or a different point of view on the situation in Israel. I mean, you know, the situation there is that there are people who have problems of identity, problems of affiliation, problems of national affiliation. I mean, I think it's a global problem. You mentioned, I think you mentioned a former Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it is global. I mean, in my own particular personal case, of course, it's a problem which is exacerbated by considerations of race and racism. But, you know, it could equally well be the case that somebody might have questions of identity which are rooted in their faith, their gender, their sexuality, as well as their nationality. So I think it's a universal question that where many people in the world are grappling with, and in my case certainly the fact that I'm of African origin and part of the African diaspora has contributed towards that problem, if you like.
Mm-hmm. The book has this almost triangular structure in a sense that models this triangle of the slave trade, that with one point in Britain and one point in Africa and one point in the southern United States.
Sure. I mean, I was listening to you describe the book, and I was wishing I could sort of take you around the country with me before I did a reading that you could explain it how you did. I mean, I thought you explained it very succinctly, because it is a difficult book to sum up in terms of its mixture of reportage, memoir, social history, but certainly the easiest aspect of the book to grasp is the fact that it is kind of triangular in shape, in terms of it being three long essays, all of which deal with the apexes of what has become known to us as the slave triangle, the slave trading triangle, where the ships left Europe, arrived in the African coast, usually the West African coast, and then arrived in the Americas, which is the third point of the triangle. So I kind of used this as a sort of organizational motif for the book.
This first leg from the Caribbean to Britain, in a sense, is you're retracing the steps that your parents took and that you took probably when you were too young to really have much memory of that experience, that took them from the place that you were born there to the place where you grew up.
Sure. Before I got into the sort of main body of the book, if you like, there's a prologue which does trace, I call it Atlantic Crossing. It does trace my own journey from the Caribbean a couple of years ago as an adult, on a banana boat going from the Caribbean to England. I mean, it's a journey I wanted to undertake a couple of years ago because way back when, it's a journey that I undertook in the arms of my parents as a child, and a journey which they never really fully explained to me the reasoning behind their migration. They never really, like most first-generation migrants, they wanted to protect their children to some extent. They didn't explain the hardships, the difficulties, the fears, the longing that placed them on that ship to England, that banana boat. And so, as an adult, I really wanted to go and make that journey myself and, if you like, meditate on the relationship between the Caribbean and Britain and the relationship between myself and my parents and the whole notion of migrancy and travel and what this means to us, both then, 40 years ago, and today at the, you know, the dawn of a new century.
Mm. That kind of journey, making that journey on a boat is something that almost no one does anymore.
Yeah, with good reason, too.
Yes, indeed. It's uncomfortable. It takes a long time. It's not exactly a pleasant way to travel. But does that somehow make one think differently about the journey and the arrival than you would if you simply got on an airplane and a few hours later in maybe relative discomfort, depending on what kind of class you travel in, it's certainly a very different experience. How does that make you think differently about the experience?
Well, I mean, I've traveled from the Caribbean to Britain on an airplane many, many times, but, we're talking about 7-8 hours in a sealed capsule watching TV with people kind enough to bring you as many drinks as you could consume and bad food and, old newspapers. And before you know where it is, you're bleary-eyed and you're at Heathrow. There's no real time for meditation or reflection. The reason I chose to travel in quite an uncomfortable and, you know, unnerving way in some respects. I was on a freighter ship, and there was only a couple of other passengers who didn't speak English. The reason I chose to travel that way was to try to recreate some of the discomfiture, some of the yearning for terra firma, some of the fear, if you like, of the unknown, certainly fear of the sea, that my parents, who at the time when they made that journey in the late 50s, were 25 and 20, father and mother respectively. So, yeah, it was a completely different experience, and one which did allow for inner reflection. And at times, I thought more profoundly about their lives and their experiences than I ever would have done. Yeah. An airplane.
In that section, after you've described the fact that this is indeed a ship that's designed to carry cargo and there are rooms for a few passengers, you write that you, at one point, I begin to wonder why anybody would willingly subject themselves to serving time on a ship that is primarily designed to carry cargo and not human beings. Then you go on to talk about that a little bit. But it strikes me that that the ease with which we travel now has changed the way we think about what this is all about, and that it's this might be indeed one way to recapture just how significant a step it would have been at the time when this was the way you did it, and the idea of just hopping on a plane and going back and forth so easily. That we have that idea now, but this makes one think more of the time when people who were leaving Europe to come to the United States, their families literally held wakes for them because this symbolically was the death of the person because they knew they'd never see them again.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not like that anymore.
Well, I think you have to have, or one has to have, a reasonably good, strong, preferably personal reason to place yourself in any type of discomfort when you're traveling. I mean, obviously, I did have strong personal reasons to do that, and it made me think a lot about the courage of young migrants from, in this instance, from the Caribbean, going over the horizon to a country which they expected. I mean, they expected from this country because they were citizens. They were colonial citizens. They were British passport holders. It made me realize the magnitude of this journey, the degree of expectation that they held. It really does depend on each individual why one would retrace that journey. I could understand, for instance, why somebody of Irish ancestry might wish to return to the village or the region of Ireland where their grandparents or parents came from, and you know, spend the night in the local house that a relative grew up in, and it may not be a Holiday Inn or a Hilton or a nice hotel, and it may be uncomfortable, but there is a strong personal reason sometimes for which makes logical the difficult circumstances that we often or sometimes put ourselves in.
Mm. I probably should reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Carl Phillips. He's a writer, maybe best known as a novelist, although, and indeed he has written 6 novels. In addition, though, he's written film scripts and scripts for theater and radio and television, and a couple of nonfiction books. His most recent, the one we're talking about here this morning, is titled The Atlantic Sound, and it's published by Knopf. And he's talking with us this morning from Chicago. So your questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. When you go to Britain, the city that you write about, the place that you write about is Liverpool, which is has been for a long, long time a very important port city. I guess that I did not know, though, just how significant a role that Liverpool played in the slave trade as a, I guess, as a departure point for the material that was then taken to Africa, exchanged for slaves, and then also when the slaves went to the United States, and then the goods were picked up on that end and went back and completed the other end of the triangle. Are there ways in which you still, in some way, in Liverpool, see something that's left from that time, or what is left from that time?
Well, there are indeed ways in which you see what is left from that town, that time. The difficulty with some cities, and Liverpool is certainly a prime example of this, is that some cities like to reinscribe and reinterpret their history. They like to invent, mythologize. I mean, we do this in a sense when we talk about ourselves to individuals. If you're talking about your life to one person, it's probably not going to be the same narrative that you will unfold when you're talking to another person. But cities have a similar ability to self-mythologize themselves. And if they have an aspect of their history which is uncomfortable, dark, troubling, then obviously they wish to hide it. Liverpool, on arrival in Liverpool, the thing I think that greets most strangers to the city is the magnificence of the architecture. After London, it's surprising to some people to realize that it's not Bath or Bristol or Birmingham or Manchester that boasts the most listed protected buildings in Britain. It's Liverpool. And I think the most visible evidence of Liverpool's complicity in the slave trade is the grandeur of the architecture.
Mm. It no doubt would have been an important place anyway, and a prosperous place anyway, but perhaps not as important as prosperous if it had not been for the slave trade.
There was no possibility of Liverpool becoming even vaguely as prosperous as it subsequently became without the slave trade. Liverpool was lagging far behind London, Bristol, Manchester, far behind these other urban conurbations, until she discovered that she had an excellent deep water harbor. She had a very, very good supply of cheap labor through Irish immigration into Liverpool, and she had one of the most important shipbuilding industries in Europe. And very quickly, by the end of the 18th century, towards the end of the 18th century, three-fifths of the whole European slave trade was emanating from Liverpool. Not just three-fifths of the British slave trade, the whole European slave trade, including Portugal, France, Spain. It was a quite phenomenal situation where basically once every 2 to 3 days, a fully crewed, fully laden ship was leaving Liverpool for the west coast of Africa, and a fully crewed ship that could accommodate 300 to 400 African slaves once the ship arrived. So you can obviously do the math oneself and work out exactly what that meant in terms of revenue, in terms of the importance, the centrality of the trade, and in terms of exactly how many people were leaving the shores of Africa for the New World.
Mm. At the same time that you talk about Liverpool in the present day and visiting there, you also include in this a story of another man who went to Liverpool from Africa in 1881.
To
work out some trade difficulties involving his father and looking at the issue of whether why he hadn't been paid for something that he had shipped from Africa to Britain. And so the father sent the son to go to find out what was going on. And so you see Liverpool then through the eyes of this man, and it's a way of getting some contrast between then and now, and also I think it tells the story very nicely in a way that would be perhaps otherwise a bit more dry and historical. What we're getting is the account of an individual of that time visiting there. Why did you decide on that kind of device to try to recreate what Liverpool would have been like at that time?
You've already answered it, actually, when you said that, because it would have been dry and historical. I mean, one can recount the social history of the times and quote statistics ad infinitum, but, I mean, the fact is, you know, essentially my business is fiction and characters and the drama that ensnares the life of individuals, and so I find it very hard to recount facts or you know, turn research around without introducing human drama. And It was such a striking story. As you say, there was an African trader on the west coast of Africa who was trading freely in the wake of the abolition of the slave trade with a Liverpool merchant who cheated him, basically. He remitted goods in order to pay for a ship to be built in Liverpool that would subsequently be sent to Africa so that this man could conduct his business upriver with more ease and efficiency. The man sent all the goods. The ship never arrived, and so obviously he had been cheated. Rather than just take this on the chin, he sent his son, his eldest son, his pride and joy, a young man, to Liverpool. The man had never left Africa. He sent him to Liverpool to try to find the individual who had cheated him and try to get the money back. And it's quite a remarkable story that the African son arrived in Liverpool and eventually tracked down the individual, took him to court, and won the court case.
Mm. So when you see Liverpool, when you try to see Liverpool through the eyes of this man, and then you see it through your own eyes, how are those two Liverpools then now really the same place?
They're the same place because it's a place then and it's a place now which is not very comfortable with itself. It's a place in which there is a certain degree of cheating, a certain degree of hiding of the facts, of tucking things away neatly out of sight, be it the money that we take from an individual or be it the money we take from an institution such as slavery and the legacy of that that betrayal of its own history is still very much evident in Liverpool. I mean, when most people, I'm sure if you ask most people in Illinois what they thought when you utilize the term Liverpool, they would say the Beatles or, the Merseybeat music. Maybe some who follow soccer would think of the football teams, which are both very successful, but very few people would think slavery. Very few people would think of a city which built its wealth, built its reputation, built its name and its status on the back of the slave trade. It just wouldn't occur to most people.
The next leg of the trip that you make in the book is then to go from Britain to Africa, specifically to Ghana, visiting a place that was the place where then slaves were put on ships from there and then taken to the United States. How do people there, Africans there, think about this part of their history?
Well, I'm generalizing now because obviously I can only speak of the people that I encountered, but a kind of barometer test of the range of opinions that I encountered would say that most people in Ghana and in the particular part of Ghana that I was in seemed to regard it somewhat pragmatically. It was a business. It was an unfortunate business, but obviously to some extent it was a business which it may have been emotionally painful and coruscating to certain individuals, to certain other African individuals. It was a business which allowed them to flourish economically because the myth that we're often handed down by teachers, textbooks, the media, that the slave trade was basically a bunch of white guys from European countries who one day appeared on the West African coast with guns and rounded up all these black guys and women and shipped them off to Africa is obviously nonsense. There was such a thing as collaboration. It was an African business as well as a European business.
Hmm. The first part of this trip, that is the trip from the Caribbean to Britain, was for you a kind of homecoming because you had grown up in Britain. But this essay about this next leg is titled Homeward Bound. Did it for you feel on some level like a kind of a homecoming?
I think for anybody of African origin, to be honest, who finds oneself to be in the West, whether in the Americas or in Europe, but the descendant of people who were shipped out of Africa involuntarily. A return to Africa or a visit to Africa is to some extent an emotional trip. It's a rekindling of the past. It's a rejoining of some kind of umbilical cord to a past that you were yoked away from. After all, you know, the African American or the African person in the diaspora is generally the descendant of the only migrant group into the West, certainly the only migrant group into the United States of America, who came involuntarily, who were not asked, who were not fleeing a pogrom, who were not fleeing a potato famine, who were not fleeing the difficulties of war or economic underdevelopment. Africans didn't ask. People of African origin didn't ask to come. Therefore, to return, however briefly, to a place which one left involuntarily is a homecoming of some sort. The difficulty that many faced, and to some extent I'm no different, is that, you know, one doesn't want to return viewing Africa or the African continent through rose-tinted spectacles. You know, one has moved on, and you know, there is very little purpose in arriving with a the freight of romance burdening one down.
And do people do that?
Absolutely, and I understand why they would do that. But you know, my purpose in visiting I've visited many times, but my purpose in writing the particular essay in the book, Homeward Bound, was to try to examine some of the ironies and difficulties which do, I think, afflict people who arrive expecting Africa to perhaps solve psychological, spiritual problems that have been engendered by trying to live and survive in what is often an institutionally racist society, a society which is discriminating against them on the basis that they are of African origin. Therefore, you know, it's difficult to expect people to arrive without expecting something. So I'm trying to explore in this particular essay the problematics, if you like, of belonging, expectation, rejection, and what that makes one think about home. Where is home? Once one's arrived in Africa and perhaps realized that this is a home of some sorts, but it's not a home today because certain things that you're used to are not there, then I think the question of just what is home and how am I going to comport myself once I return, these become very important questions.
We have a caller. Would welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's good for all of the local listeners. And if you would be outside of the immediate area here, and it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Champaign County, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. I was wondering... I have a couple of questions because the first one might not go anywhere. We see a lot of cultural product from England, and one of the things I viewed recently was a mini series depicting the slave trade. And I'm, for the life of me, can't remember the title of it or the producers. I don't know if it was BBC or Channel 4, but it was interesting that it was thought to be something to treat. But far be it for me to complain about a depiction of class, but it seems to me that part of the drama was, and this is why I like British product, I guess, is because they do treat class more than U.S. Cultural product, whatever dramas do. But I wonder if it's not some kind of misrepresentation in some way in that... is it really true that smallholders would, you know, make their fortune as a slaver, or is it not true that it was really more the more integrated into the aristocracy and the cultural. I don't know. I don't know if you can handle that. The other question, if you can at all, is if you've been following, as we do here, because Insomniacs listen to the BBC late into the night here, the discussion about a document that was just released in England about this challenge of diversity or something, and trying to break this the monolith of the cultural image. As you say, it's easier here to be a hyphenated American, I guess, in some ways, but we still get people complaining about, you know, African-American cultural programs and Latino programs. I mean, it's a constant refrain here, despite the fact that it is perhaps more accepted in some ways. So I have to hang up, and I can't engage in repartee, but I hope someone else calls in, and I'll listen to some of your thoughts on these momentarily. I don't know if you actually saw that. That film. Thanks.
Okay. Well, can you make some response to the?
Yeah. The first point about class, I think, is a very important point. You know, I think that it does frustrate me as well that in this country, the notion of the relationship of race to class and the interconnectedness of the two isn't often acknowledged. I mean, I've perhaps grown up and developed as a writer and as a thinker with a very strong sense of class being a determining factor in nearly all social decisions, particularly as a northerner. I grew up in the north of England in the working class, so I do think it's a point. Whether or not how one, you know, draws out from this to make a distinction between the aristocracy or the smallholders or the middle class or the lower middle class. You know, there are people who have done work in this area. There's fiction and nonfiction which examines this. My book, this particular book, doesn't really tackle that, but it's a perfectly valid point. You know, it enriched all levels of society, if truth be known, but there was a level of society, upper classes, who were obviously more invested in it than were the middle and the working classes. As far as the series, I'm not sure, because to be perfectly honest, I spend a lot of time in the United States or traveling, and have done in the last couple of years, so a lot of things that I would have watched in the BBC and if I had, or Channel 4 in England, I just haven't seen or caught up with. And I forget what the second...
Well, I guess, generally speaking, I took the question to be something like, well, how well is Britain doing, in fact, dealing with the challenges of multiculturalism?
Yes, there was a report that was released, I think, last week by an organization called the Runnymede Trust, and I sort of follow this debate for personal and professional reasons. People are trying to change things in Britain, and it is certainly true that I don't want to become too party political here, but certainly since the Labour Party came to power a few years ago, you know, things have changed. I mean, the Conservative Party, pretty much as the name suggests, tend to have a much more imperial sense of British history, a sense of British history that is slightly less wedded to a heterogeneous view of its citizenry. So I think things are changing, and people are trying to loosen up definitions in Britain. It's changed enormously since I was a kid, and it appears to be changing with increasing vigor in the last couple of years.
Let's talk with someone else. This is callers in Paris. That is Paris, Illinois. Line number 4. Hello.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder, I'd like to ask your guest if he's familiar with James Michener, as probably everybody is, but his book on Africa, I reread it probably about 3 times. And that's basically my entire knowledge of Africa. But I just wonder if he's a credible author and if his facts were straight. I'll hang up to listen to your comment.
Well, all right.
Well, I'm not familiar with the book. James Michener's certainly a credible author, but whether this book is credible or not, I honestly couldn't say. I mean, what I would say, though, that is, you know, I mean, without wishing to be too controversial, is that I wouldn't just read James Michener on Africa. I'd probably try and read an African. You know, as well as James Michener. It doesn't mean that James Michener doesn't have a point of view, which is valid, but there's plenty of terrific African novelists and historians which I think would offer either complementary or parallel or maybe in some cases slightly oppositional, positively oppositional view to James Michener. So, you know, if I'm going to go to Germany, I tend to try and find books that are written by Germans. If I'm going to Australia, I like to read what the latest Australian social historian or historian might have to say. So, I mean, maybe that would be a way of your caller finding out whether Michener is credible or not.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left, by the way, in this part of Focus 580. Carl Phillips is our guest. He's a novelist who also has written nonfiction works. He's also written scripts for film and theater and radio and television. As we mentioned at the beginning of the program, he was born in the West Indies when he was quite young. His family went to England, and he grew up there in Leeds. He went to school at Oxford. Now he's spends his time living in the United States. He has a home in New York. He's talking with us this morning from Chicago. He has authored this book that we're talking about here titled The Atlantic Sound, and it's published by Knopf. And as I tried to explain at the beginning of the program, in part it is travel writing, in part it is history, in part it is social commentary, but all having to do one way or another with the idea of identity and how one thinks about the place one calls home and how one even gets to the point of calling someplace home. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. The last leg of the journey is that from Africa to South Carolina. So here now you're coming back to perhaps to a place that you have learned to think of as home or learned to call home, that is the United States. Having now made these other two trips, in effect retracing your parents' steps from the Caribbean to Britain, then going to Africa, and now in a sense retracing the steps of those people who were brought as slaves to the United States, against their will, brought to the United States, and had no choice about it, had to make their way in the United States. How does that lead you now to think about the United States? Did that indeed cause you to think differently?
I think the longer I live in this country, the more I realize I don't live in this country. I live in New York City. Which, you know, every time I travel outside of New York City, I realize the extent to which New York City is hardly representative of the rest of the United States. So I'm always very wary about drawing conclusions about United States culture, society, politics, based on, in fact, not even New York City, based on the kind of gated community of Manhattan, which is where I live. However, I am obviously interested in the United States, and have been, because I've been teaching at least one semester a year, American students for the last 10 years. So my interest has been piqued by listening to the various parts of this country, where they come from, their different experiences based on whether they're from the South, from California, from the Northeast, wherever. And, you know, obviously an area of the country that I've been very interested in is that area where the African population, though the vast majority of it, arrived, which is the South. Charleston, in particular, because Charleston's history in the United States is extremely important, the place where the Civil War started, the place where the first train in the United States ran, the place where there was the first museum in the United States. Culturally, very important, Porgy and Bess and so forth. So I went to Charleston with the hope of finding out about Charleston's relationship to the United States vis-a-vis the prism of slavery and the arrival of Africans into this country. And what I found was very surprising to me in many ways.
Well, in what way? In what ways?
Well, I didn't realize to start with that some 30 to 30, about 30% of the African population which landed in the United States landed in Charleston. In other words, you know, one in three African Americans were essentially bought and sold in Charleston. I looked around pretty vigorously whilst I was down there for some kind of monument or museum or some kind of civic acknowledgement of this fact, and was both surprised and then disturbed to find nothing.
I think, not meaning to defend the South or South Carolina, I think perhaps in recent years, very slowly, they have come to begin to acknowledge slavery. But it certainly is true when you look at the way that they talk about their history, the way that they have tried to preserve or recreate. It's really in almost all cases stunningly absent. It's just a big blank page.
To be fair, David, you see, I'm not attacking the South, and certainly that's not my brief, and there's nothing to be gained by doing that. I'm not actually talking about slavery either. I'm talking about American social history. I'm talking about an acknowledgement of something that has profoundly affected the lives of every American, irrespective of color, background, race, creed, ethnicity. It's as important that there should be some acknowledgement of this place and the history of this place and the particular history that happened in this place, because it's a history which affects American life, American social, political, economic, cultural, sporting life, and all Americans should be aware of it.
Well, you're quite right. No, I was not meaning to suggest that you were doing those things. I think about the little bit we talked about Liverpool and how when you go there, what you see is directly related to the fact that it was an important port and that it was involved in the slave trade. Thinking now here about the United States and what you say about the fact that there is no monument to commemorating what the involvement of Charleston. There must, though, be other ways in more subtle things that if you know where to look, that you do indeed see that.
Oh, sure. But, I mean, I think that's the problem. And it's not just Charleston. It's, as you suggest, it's Liverpool, too. It's London. It's Paris. I mean, there are many cities. When I was younger and traveling in the former Eastern Europe, what was then, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, I used to go to a lot of museums in East Berlin and Dresden and Warsaw and look at how the history was presented at that time under the Soviet influence, and it was lamentable because, you know, what characterized it was what was left out. However, you could step onto the streets, you could speak to individuals, you could do the necessary research, and you could dredge up, if you like, the truth behind the official silence. And so it's certainly possible to do that in Charleston. It's just rather sad that one has to step, you know, into these alleyways, corners, make these phone calls. I mean, in other words, it's just rather sad that one has to do a bit of detective work. It would have been, you know, much more pleasant if these things were nearer the surface. But there are people who are working towards that.
Well, if you forgive me for reaching back to what is now sort of a cliched phrase, that phrase that says you can't go home again. In this particular, in the case of your journey, was there indeed homecoming anywhere, or was there homecoming everywhere?
I grew up, as I suggested, and near the beginning of our talk, as a young boy and then as a young man in a Britain which I never really felt comfortable in, because I was always made to feel as though I didn't belong in some respects. And I realized over the years that there are many people in many different countries, in many different societies, who perhaps have grown up with what I call the sort of high anxiety of belonging or not belonging. But I think it's changing for many, many people, so much so that they can feel as much at home in Warsaw as they do in Chicago, or they can feel as much at home in Beijing as they do in San Francisco. And for me, the thing that really I felt at the end of all my meandering and traveling and note-taking and interviewing of various people for this particular project, which ultimately became the book, The Atlantic Sound, was that I did feel in many ways at home in Britain. I felt at home in Charleston. I felt at home in Africa. I didn't feel that I was being forced by anybody anywhere to make a choice. And when I did feel that a choice was being thrust upon me, I felt strong enough to resist and to say, I'm sorry, my identity is made up of a bit of here, a bit of there, and a bit of over there. And if it's too complex for you to hold, then I'm sorry, that's your problem, because I'm living with it quite comfortably.
I think that's an interesting notion, that we may maybe moving towards thinking about identity in a way that is more more open or fluid or flexible, a less limited sort of concept.
Well, it's in some ways, it seems to me a much more realistic way of looking at identity as we're able to travel with greater ease and facility. You know, we talked a bit before about the difference between getting on a plane and getting on a boat. These days, we are able to keep in touch, you know, with places with an astonishing ease. We're able to communicate, to travel, to telephone, to keep hold of a second language or even a third language in a way in which we couldn't do a generation ago. And therefore, I think that the notion of identity is only going to become increasingly complex, and I think it's a good thing if we perhaps give up the idea that some person has to be only viewed as whole if they can write their identity essentially on the back of a matchbox. Maybe they want to write a couple of sentences.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I hope we've given people some sense of what the book is about, and certainly I would encourage people to go out and look at it, The Atlantic Sound, published by Knopf, by our guest Carl Phillips. And we want to say to you, Mr. Phillips, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on your show. Thanks to the people who called in, and I enjoyed talking to you.